You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 13th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It is vacation week, but the new content never stops on this program, more or less. Today on the program, Justin Elliott of ProPublica on his deep dive into the Red Cross's work or not work in Haiti. Great piece of reporting that Justin Elliott did. And a fascinating look at what I think people really just sort of, I don't know, knee-jerk when there is some type of catastrophe, natural disaster. I think it's a knee-jerk response to give money to the Red Cross. And I think there's a pretty compelling case that you should really think twice about that. Also on the program, for members, and this is for members only, ladies and gentlemen, will be a something from the Deep Archive. It is a Bernie Sanders appearing on the original Majority Report back in April of 2005. This is a all of our member archives this week have been picked by our chief archive curator, who also happens to be our intern, Noah. Noah, why don't you speak up and tell people why Bernie Sanders is your choice?
Well, he's my choice for president, and I thought it'd be kind of interesting to like reflect and
see. You got to speak into the microphone.
Oh, sorry. I thought it'd be interesting to reflect and see how far we've come 8 years from the past and just kind of get a sense of what Bernie was like on Sam's show and the history.
Okay. Interns at this show learn how to speak into a mic.
That's one of the first things they got to learn. All right. Well, so we're going to be hearing from picks from Noah all this week, ladies and gentlemen. And I imagine by Tuesday or Wednesday, he will be talking into the microphone. And then it'll be that's the show today. Justin Elliott on the Red Cross. And for members, a Bernie Sanders interview from the Deep Archive. We should have probably some type of we should come up with that. I'm going to write that down. Deep Archive, like audio package.
It's going to be huge. A deep archive of me, Bernie Sanders.
Oh, there we go. This is Matt. This is like right before he becomes a dad. This he's getting
by this time, though.
That's right. It's right now, and we're actually recording this in not. Yeah, like a week in advance. Oh, my gosh. We're really on top of it this year, this for this vacation. For all I know, your kid could be born. It's possible, though, this day, today, when people are listening to this, or Monday the 13th, that's when your kid's due, right? Or was it yesterday?
It was yesterday, the 12th, July 12th. But it's
oh, you're sweating bullets.
I think it's going to be before that.
Well, yeah, I don't know, buddy. The first one sometimes is late, too. All right. Well, enjoy this show, folks. Tomorrow on the program, we have Saqib Bhatti. And then later in the week, Saqib Bhatti will be talking about Detroit and Chicago. And then on Wednesday, we've got a show where I've interviewed Murtaza Hussein on this incredible story of the Fork Disks 5. Folks, this is, it's enraging. It's just unbelievable. And then the end of the week will be Scott Timberg on the culture crash, the killing of the creative class. We're going to take, well, here's the show, and we'll be back tomorrow with new content. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Justin Elliott. He is a reporter with ProPublica. Justin, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be here.
So you did an investigative report, I believe, with NPR.
Yeah, that's right, with Laura Sullivan, who's on NPR's investigative team.
And it is about what happened to the literally $500 million the Red Cross raised for Haiti earthquake relief. There's been many stories over the years about the how the Red Cross functions. And I think for most people, the Red Cross is the most obvious answer when they think about providing relief to places like Haiti after an earthquake, or even in the context of New York, post-Sandy relief. Let's talk about this piece that you wrote about Haiti. Just give us the background first. I mean, I think people recall the Haiti earthquake, but give us a sense of what they were facing in Haiti.
Sure. So the earthquake that hit Haiti was in January 2010, and, you know, it was incredibly devastating. It was one of the, killed tens and tens of thousands of people. I think the majority of the government buildings in Port-au-Prince were just destroyed. Haiti before the earthquake was, not exactly thriving.
Incredibly poor.
Incredibly poorest place in the Western Hemisphere, sort of by far. If you look at the sort of GDP numbers for the globe, you know, Haiti's always somewhere next to like Sierra Leone. So it was even though it's not so far off the coast of the United States. So it was definitely a very challenging situation. But bringing it to the American Red Cross, I mean, one sort of interesting thing to note about the American Red Cross that I think a lot of people did not know when they donated money after the earthquake was that they really hadn't been in Haiti before the earthquake. They didn't have roots there. They didn't have operations there in any significant way, unlike some other nonprofits. So it was really a sort of new place for them to be operating as well.
And that seems to be, part of the issue here, it appears to me. But before we get to that, give us a sense of what kind of shape the Red Cross was in at this time. Because I think, there's something about charities where we don't really contemplate, I think, as just in general, we don't contemplate, like, this is, in some respects, a business. It's just that their bottom line is a little bit different, but the dynamics that go on inside can be very much like a corporate entity, particularly in the context of, in the case of the Red Cross.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It's a huge organization. I mean, it's a nonprofit organization, but, they have top officers who are making, many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's certainly a charity, but it's there's not profits or stockholders. But they take in actually around $3 billion a year in revenue. Most of that, it turns out, actually has nothing to do with disaster relief. It's from their blood business. If you give blood, they sell it to hospitals, and that generates a couple billion dollars a year. The rest of the organization, or sort of most of the rest of it, is this disaster relief. But they had actually been struggling for several years. Some people may remember, after Hurricane Katrina, there was, basically a scandal involving the American Red Cross response to Katrina. There was fraud going on, and also just sort of general inadequacy of their providing relief after Katrina. Congress had actually gotten involved, and there was legislation that was passed that overhauled the American Red Cross's governance structure. Even though it's a private charity, it actually has a sort of unique relationship with the U.S. government, because it turns out it was actually chartered by the U.S. Congress. So Haiti was really sort of the biggest disaster that happened was the biggest disaster after Katrina. It was the first sort of big disaster they were trying to deal with after Katrina. Although one key difference, obviously, is that this was not in America, where they do have roots and they do operate all the time.
So, when did you start to I guess noodle around in this story? I mean, we're 4 years after. I guess essentially when the Red Cross launched the project, I guess, to transform Haiti. When did give us a sense of when of what alerted you to this, and also when they started their fundraising, their major fundraising off of about Haiti.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually it's a little bit paradoxical. I actually started looking at this after doing a bunch of previous reporting around the American Red Cross's response to Hurricane Sandy here in New York, and that was in 2012, obviously, after the Haiti earthquake. But we published a big piece looking at their Sandy response. They raised around $300+ million after Sandy, and there were a lot of problems there.
Yeah, let's take a moment to talk about that. I was gonna
sure.
circle back, but let's discuss that now. I didn't realize they had raised that much money. And the story that you're talking about, I mean, the part that I remember anyways had to do with the way that they were basically operating with Occupy. Is that right?
There was an Occupy angle. So basically, the sort of focus of that story was, I mean, part of the focus was sort of what happened to all this money. And by the way, we never really got a comprehensive answer to that question. But another sort of main focus was, we heard from a lot of people who had worked for the American Red Cross who came to us, and many of them became on the record sources in the story, that the senior management in Washington was really prioritizing sort of public relations and brand management concerns above sort of humanitarianism and actually sort of delivering relief. So to give one of a bunch of examples, within a week or two of Sandy, there was an incident where the CEO of the Red Cross, a woman named Gail McGovern, was in New York and having a press conference on Staten Island. And they actually called up a bunch of drivers who were going around in their relief trucks, supposed to be handing out food and water and blankets and that kind of thing in areas that were affected by Sandy, and told them to turn around and report to this press conference so they could be so these trucks could be backdrops for the CEO. And so they were actually sort of diverting relief resources for PR purposes. And this happened again and again. There was another incident in which this was actually not in Sandy, but a previous storm, Hurricane Isaac in the Gulf, where they actually ordered a bunch of trucks to drive around empty because just to be seen by TV cameras. So there was a pattern of this, and it was in internal documents that we published with the story. In terms of Occupy, another thing that happened, according to multiple Red Cross employees and Occupy people, was that there was a policy that came down saying that American Red Cross workers were not supposed to have contact with or any kind of coordination with Occupy Sandy, which was this sort of ad hoc, sort of decentralized movement to do relief after Sandy. And that actually caused big problems in the sort of early days after the storm, because Occupy Sandy sort of had deeper roots in the neighborhoods and, you know, knew where the needs were, but didn't have all the money and resources of the Red Cross. So it actually could have been, theoretically anyways, a sort of fruitful relationship. But for political reasons, because they saw Occupy, or at least some people in management at the Red Cross saw Occupy as sort of scary anarchist communists. I don't know what they saw them as. This policy came down that a lot of, like, sort of rank-and-file Red Cross employees and volunteers were upset about. So that was sort of a taste of the Sandy story. But if you want to read 4,000 words on it, go to ProPublica.
We will we'll put a link to that story as well. But that, I mean, what's relevant, I mean, obviously, what's relevant in terms of the leadership of the Red Cross is that Gail McGovern came in, I don't know if it was around the time of the earthquake, or ostensibly came in as a sort of to reform the organization, right? I mean, so
that's right. Yeah, she came in. She came in about a year and a half before the Haiti earthquake in 2010. So they'd gone through a sort of string of CEOs. The Katrina thing disaster had happened. Then they had another CEO who left after 6 months in like a sex scandal. And so it was not a good time, and she was brought in, and she's still the CEO, as a sort of, yeah, as you say, somebody who's going to reform the organization. Sort of, she's from corporate America. She had sort of spent most of her career at AT&T. She was a professor of marketing at Harvard Business School, was her immediately preceding gig. And
that may tell you everything you need to know, but I think, you know, the point being that the story about what was going on with Hurricane Sandy, it seems to me, you know, because I mean, one could say, like, look, if you come into an organization this large, it's conceivable that even 16 months out, 18 months out, you still haven't been able to reform the culture in this organization to effectively address some of those problems when you are then attempting to address a disaster like we saw in Haiti. But it seems to me that rather than that being the case, this is more of the character of the organization, period.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to sort of disaggregate these things. I mean, I can say that in the Sandy case, certainly, a lot of people who worked there, including some at high levels, saw all of this sort of PR and brand focus emanating, you know, from the very top of the organization. And that, I think, certainly can be attributed to Gail McGovern's leadership. I mean, in terms of what happened after Haiti, one interesting thing that a lot of people mentioned to us when we were reporting about it is, you know, the American Red Cross had this huge fundraising apparatus that they, you know, set into motion right after the Haiti earthquake. And, of course, there's nothing sort of wrong with that on its face. But one thing they did differently than some others is they kept fundraising even after there was enough money to do sort of what they traditionally do, which is immediate relief, providing food and shelter, food and water and that sort of thing, sort of directly after a disaster. You know, ultimately, out of the $500 million roughly raised, something like under 15% was actually spent on the emergency relief phase, which is what they are sort of traditionally known for doing. In contrast, Doctors Without Borders actually stopped fundraising a little while after the Haiti earthquake because they were getting such a flood of donations. They actually came out and said publicly, you know, we think we have enough to do what we need to do in Haiti, so stop giving us money. The American Red Cross never did that. You know, at the time they were running budget deficits, and they do keep a percentage of the money in headquarters, even if you give for Haiti, a cut of it goes to the sort of general operating fund. So all the money they raise sort of helps their bottom line.
So, I mean, I want to get into sort of the claims versus what you found on the ground. But when you start to lay it out that way, it's basically that they came up with an idea of how to spend that money after they saw they could raise it all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, another thing that I learned about the American Red Cross sort of through doing this reporting that I didn't know before is that, you know, they have a sort of international services division, but it's very small, and they historically have not really done sort of reconstruction work in a developing country. And that's really what Haiti was in terms of raising all this money after the earthquake. I mean, obviously, there were sort of immediate needs, but a very small percentage of the money was spent on that. And the rest of it left over, I mean, you had this country that was devastated. The infrastructure, which was already weak, was, you know, much of it was destroyed and needed a lot of help in those areas. And the American Red Cross just simply doesn't have much experience in doing those things, certainly not in Haiti. So a lot of the problems that we found in our reporting of their program, I think flowed from that sort of lack of experience. And that's not just me sort of speculating. I mean, people told us that who worked on the programs again and again.
So what is the program? I mean, if I understand correctly, the earthquake hits. The Red Cross basically flicks on their disaster relief fundraising machine, right? And they raise – now, theoretically, they either have a line of credit or they have funds at their disposal, or do they only go as far as the money they're getting? I mean, what are the mechanics of that?
You know, I don't know specifically, partly because the organization is really sort of a black box in terms of the finances. I do know in the broadest terms that they do have, I mean, it's big enough that they have enough cash on hand to start immediately. Like, they don't, you know, wait until
the first checks come in.
Exactly. So, I mean, they, you know, they have Michelle Obama, they have the NFL, they have a million celebrities who are going to be fundraising for them. You know, it's not that much of a risk to start moving when you know that you're going to have almost certainly millions, tens of millions of dollars coming in. So that's not an issue. In fact, you know, as I was saying, in this case, it was kind of the opposite. They ended up with far, far, far more money than you could ever spend on the sort of immediate relief phase, especially given that there were literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other NGOs responding to Haiti, governments, U.S. military. So, I mean, Haiti was flooded with internationals. I mean, even before this, there's a nickname for Haiti, the Republic of NGOs. I mean, it's sort of it's this weird place when you go there. There's just these NGO people everywhere.
I mean, typically, like, so for instance, you obviously spoke to people at Doctors Without Borders. I mean, that's how you found out that they stopped fundraising when they had enough to fulfill what they saw as their role in providing immediate aid. So the Red Cross turns on this switch and they get things going. They have they either have the cash reserves or they have the line of credit. They can get stuff on a 30-day, whatever it is, or a 60-day float. They can get the airlines or they can get the food supplies. And then the money just keeps rolling in. At what point did they say, like, okay, we've far surpassed, you know, 15% of 500 million, I guess, is, I don't know, about 65, 75. We've gotten $75 million. We have now paid for our operating cost, and we've, you know, used all the money to hand out blankets, presumably, and more. At what point did they say, okay, now we're up around 150 million. Now we're at 200 million, 300 million, 400 million. At what point did they say, We should decide what we're going to do with this money, or we should decide what we're going to announce we're going to do with this money?
You know, I'm not actually sure. I'm not privy to sort of all of the internal thinking. I can say that I did talk to a couple of people who were involved at the time, who worked there, who said that internally, Haiti was seen as a spectacular fundraising opportunity, in the words of one former official. You know, they sort of started standing up a bigger program in after the sort of immediate relief phase. It started to shift later in 2010 towards what what it ultimately became, which was this program that was focusing on building permanent housing and some other areas. So that happened in 2010. I'm not sure if that entirely answers the question or not.
I mean, it does. I mean, I'm just, you know, curious. I mean, we did an Indiegogo campaign. We set an amount that we wanted to raise, and we started going over that. Now, I had a list of some things, but at one point I was like, okay, we're not going to promote it anymore because I don't have a plan to spend that money. I have a plan to spend the money that we set out to spend. I don't have a plan
to... I should say we put this to them, the point that I was just sort of making to you, which is that other charities, sort of not just in Haiti, but including in the Haiti earthquake case, sometimes they stop fundraising because they have enough to do what they sort of have the capability to do. We asked them why, you know, what their thinking was on that, and they told us that, in fact, they do sometimes do that. And they gave an example of after the Boston Marathon bombing, everyone was given to the Red Cross, and we stop and think about that, you know, there's actually many, many fewer people affected. Like, what's the Red Cross really going to do beyond, like, the first few weeks? It's not like a mass-scale event in the way that a hurricane is. So in that case, the American Red Cross, seemingly appropriately, actually told people to stop giving to them and to start giving to one of these Boston charities that was going to sort of give money to victims or something like that. They said that in the case of Haiti, they decided not to do that, but they didn't really actually, in our correspondence with them, shed any light on why they didn't decide. But again, the only thing I was able to find out through sort of reporting through non-official channels was that it was seen as a giant fundraising opportunity. And it is also worth noting that, you know, the year of the Haiti earthquake, you know, they erased their deficit in just sort of entirely – total organizational terms. I think the previous year they were running a $100 or $200 million deficit, and the year before that it was even bigger, and the Haiti year they were actually in the black.
Wow.
And obviously some of that's from the Haiti money that, you know, at least is supposed to be earmarked for Haiti, but it makes the organization, you know.
It doesn't look great for them.
Well, I mean, it makes their books look better.
Right. Right, because they have all this cash, and for every dollar they take in, right, they automatically skim a certain percentage, it seems to me. I mean, skim, you know, I don't mean to put it like it's a, but maybe it is, like it's a racket, but, I mean, they have operating expenses. So theoretically, every dollar that they would spend in Haiti that they bring in, they would take a certain percentage for operations at home, which may go into their general fund. That's assuming they spend this money. Of that $500 million they raised, first off, where did you find that figure? And second off, what did they claim they spent it on? And third off, what did you find they spent it on?
So that figure is from them. It's actually not – it's 488, I think, is the latest. So it's almost $500 million. And, you know, one of the sort of most striking parts of all this to me, and it was true in the Sandy case too, is – They really won't tell you in any kind of meaningful way where the money spent, where the money was spent. The vast majority of it has been spent at this point. There's a little bit left, maybe like 10% still left, or 10 or 15% left. You know, the most that you can find out if you just go on their website is you can look up, they put out these annual reports about Haiti, and they have a pie chart with about six or seven slices on it. And it's shelter, you know, $175 million, health, some other amount, emergency relief, $60 or $70 million, and that's it in terms of specificity of disclosures. I mean, you can find press releases here and there where they're talking about a specific project, but in terms of a sort of comprehensive, you know, rundown of how all the money was actually spent, even something that wouldn't even be that detailed in my mind, which would be a list of projects and their cost, they won't give you. And we asked for that, you know, repeatedly, and they've never released that. So the real answer to the question is we don't know in a comprehensive way where the money was spent. However, we can say, I mean, just to look at the sort of biggest chunk of it, which was on shelter, what we found is that the CEO said early, Gail McGovern said early on after the earthquake that they were going to focus on permanent housing. They were going to build brand new communities, quote unquote, in Haiti. And we found, you know, it's now five plus years later that all of the projects to build brand new communities were ultimately delayed and scrapped, and that never happened. In terms of permanent homes, they built six, or they paid for the construction of six permanent homes only.
Six permanent homes. And I got to say, I mean, I don't know that much about Haiti, but my guess is that the construction of a permanent home in Haiti is nothing compared to $170 million.
Right. I mean, you can build one of these sort of very modest permanent homes for, you know, something on the order of $8,000 or something like that. So, you know, they did.
I mean, people should contemplate this, it seems to me, because I, you know, off the top of my head, I can't divide $170 million by 8,000. But it sounds to me like you could almost replace every single home on the island.
Yeah, I haven't done that calculation, but I mean, one thing about Haiti is it's actually very small. I mean, the entire population is only 10 million people. So $500 million is a lot of money, especially in a place where, you know, there's large segments of the population living in desperate poverty. You know, they did do other things in the shelter area. I mean, the $173 million, they paid for repairs on several thousand homes. They paid for several thousand of these things they call T-shelters, which are transitional shelters, which we have some pictures in our story, at the top of the story, which are these basically sort of one-room shacks made of like particle board in many cases that are designed to last for a few years. I mean, they can blow over in a storm, and they get, you know, if you talk to the people living in them, I mean, they're not, it's nothing like anyone in this country would consider a home. And in fact, it's not designed to last very long. So, you know, from talking to people, who work for the Red Cross in Haiti, a lot of these programs that were supposed to build permanent homes, were derailed, delayed for years because they didn't have appropriate staffing, just sort of bureaucratic problems. They hired a lot of people from outside the country who couldn't speak Creole or French and therefore couldn't work with Haitians, just a whole sort of host of problems that ultimately derailed a lot of these programs, combined with some other issues that difficulties working in Haiti that you can't pin on the Red Cross, that sort of everyone grappled with. But one other thing is other organizations did actually succeed in building thousands and thousands of permanent homes, even though the American Red Cross got by far more money than anyone else.
And so give me a sense of people on the ground in Haiti. From your piece, it sounds like when you tell people that the Red Cross supposedly spent this type of money either on projects that they were involved with or just in general, people are just shocked, right? Because, I mean, I guess the $177 million divided by 8,000 is around 23,000 homes. Mm-hmm. You'd notice it, I think.
Right?
And it's not like, it doesn't sound like the Red Cross is shy about promoting that they're doing the work there.
Right. I mean, you know, partly because it's impossible to, without getting information from them, to see all the, or to have see a list of all the projects they did. When Laura Sullivan from NPR and I went down to Haiti earlier this year to do reporting on this, we ended up deciding to go to this neighborhood in Port-au-Prince called Campeche, which is a sort of very poor, sort of typical but very, very poor neighborhood on the hillside, you know, no sort of paved roads, you know, people living in sort of shacks or things that are barely shacks. And the reason we went there is that the American Red Cross has a whole sort of press release on its website touting their work in this neighborhood with pictures of, you know, smiling children and all that kind of thing. And literally within 30 minutes of walking around this area, we met these gentlemen who live in the neighborhood and actually run this local community group that turned out was actually set up by the Red Cross to sort of be their local liaison. And they were just furious with the Red Cross. According to their account, the Red Cross came in sort of late 2011, and they were made, all these promises were made about transforming this community. The biggest part of it was going to be building hundreds and hundreds of permanent homes, and this area was also very hard hit in the earthquake. And then for a year or 2 years, essentially nothing happened, at least in the shelter arena. And we later talked to people who'd worked on the project for the Red Cross who corroborated all of this and said that it was just the whole project was derailed by sort of shifting strategies and high rates of turnover and sort of low morale and a lack of headquarters getting involved, even though they didn't know what they were doing. So for a year or two, the only thing that happened in this community was, you know, meetings were held with residents where they were sort of given juice boxes and their input was taken. And then ultimately, they canceled all the plans to build these hundreds of new homes, which is what the people had been promised, and now are sort of doing some modest improvements to the roads and pathways in the area. And the budget for this project is $24 million. And we were never able to figure out how they're spending $24 million there. And when we told these local sort of community leaders that was the budget, that was news to them, and they were just shocked because that, you know, this is a pretty small neighborhood, and that's just sort of an unimaginable amount of money for the people there. A lot of it, or significant portions of it anyway, seem to have been wasted in this period where, you know, all these sort of expat staff were being paid, but nothing was actually happening on the ground that was helping anyone there.
I mean, that's a lot of waste, though, right? I mean, millions of dollars.
Yeah, the project, I mean, this particular project is not over yet.
Right.
So some amount of that money's left. This is another case where we sort of asked for, we did ask for detailed financials about how exactly it all broke down, and they didn't provide them. So we haven't seen those. But in terms of what you can see in the neighborhood, you know, it's far, far less than what was promised.
So what is the response to the Red Cross when you guys print this this report? And is there like a board of direct? I mean, I assume that there is, right? A board of directors, a board of advisors. Isn't somebody saying like, hey, this is this is weird?
There is a board of directors. Unclear to me sort of how active it is. I mean, actually, the woman who's the chairwoman of the board of directors, her name is Bonnie McElveen Hunter, and she's actually been the chairwoman of the board since like 2004. So she's weathered. She's been there during. She was there during the Katrina thing, during Haiti, during Sandy. But you know, one thing that has happened is there's been some interest in Congress in the story, you know, Chuck Grassley's office, actually even before this story, after our sort of previous story, has been asking questions and looking at the organization, and that's still going on. And a couple of members of Congress have called for a hearing about Haiti. Yvette Clark of Brooklyn, you know, there's a large Haitian American community in her district, and she's been interested in this issue in a long time.
It's just stunning because, yeah. I mean, this, this, I don't want to jump to conclusions, but this reeks of basically just a massive fraud, right? I mean,
to be clear, we don't have any, there was no evidence.
I want to be safe here. Reeks, it smells and looks like fraud. Obviously, we don't have substantial evidence. Well, no, I don't know if there's not substantial evidence. You can't make any conclusions. But it seems to me that there's enough going on here that you would imagine there would be a lot more, I guess, outcry, right? And do you get the sense? I mean, do you have the sense that there's a give me your assessment as to whether or not there is an outcry, and give me your assessment as to why if there isn't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, actually, in terms of stories I've worked on in my career, I would say this actually rates pretty high on the sort of outcry scale. the interest from a few members of Congress is something unclear whether it'll go anywhere. There's a ton of interest in Haiti to the story. The Haitian media has been covering it closely. The American Red Cross actually called a press conference a week after the story was published, and they put some sort of mid-level seeming official in front of a large group of Haitian journalists, and he just sort of repeated their talking points and didn't actually answer any new questions, or didn't answer any questions, didn't provide any new details about spending. There's been calls in Haiti for, you know, sort of answers and accountability. Haven't heard anything from the sort of American Red Cross board of directors. You know, they certainly haven't fired anyone or anything like that to my knowledge. But sometimes these things take time. Frankly, I think it's hard to get people to care about Haiti.
Do you think it's Haiti, or do you think it's like that the Red Cross is sort of like you've just written a piece basically saying like, hey, Santa Claus is not real? I mean, honestly, because the associations you have with the Red Cross are just like all, you know, completely benign, or at least me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, it's incredibly strong and sort of storied brand, to use like the marketing lingo. And definitely I've gotten some sort of hate mail, but I would actually say that in terms of the feedback I've gotten from people directly, it's running sort of 80-20 in the sort of positive direction. I do think that as a political matter, sort of investigating the Red Cross or asking questions of the Red Cross, it's not like asking questions of like Exxon or something.
Right.
I think they're, I think it's still sort of a live issue, and we're certainly still interested in it and looking at potential follow-ups. And I think it's not necessarily over yet.
Justin, lastly, let me ask you this. When you are faced with donating to a charity that is providing relief in a situation where the Red Cross is supposedly doing the same, where do you find that you tend to donate?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think that it's actually very context-specific. I talked to a lot of people in Haiti and saw a lot of sort of experts about this question, and the sort of closest I came to an answer was not like one group, but actually more like a set of kind of guidelines that I think are actually pretty easy to follow. And those are basically before sort of just mindlessly texting money to somebody, whether it's the Red Cross or any other group, do like a tiny bit of internet research and see if what's going on with that group. You know, have they been in the news recently, et cetera? That's sort of one basic thing. Another thing, just to make sure that you have the information you need to assess whether you want to give. But the other thing, and I think the more important thing, is that we just heard repeatedly that that Haitian groups or sort of outside groups that had deep ties in Haiti and worked with Haitians, had a lot of Haitians working for them in high-level positions, did a better job, tended to do a better job after the earthquake for reasons that, you know, seemed very logical. They knew how to operate in the country.
Right.
They spoke the language, et cetera. So if something happens in Nepal, for example, I would spend like 3 minutes just looking for groups that have a already had a presence in Nepal, already worked there, or are doing something that are doing something specific that you can see that they're doing and that you would support. If you give to a group if you give to a big organization, again, whether it's the Red Cross or anyone else, and they're not active in the country, what's going to happen, I can tell you, is that organization's going to take a cut of your money,
and then
they're going to pass it on
to those
to somebody
people,
else right. who is there. So it doesn't really make sense to do it that way. So that's my advice.
Justin Elliott, the piece is, we will link to it, obviously, but you can find it at ProPublica, along with a lot of other great investigative reporting. Thanks so much for your time today. Really impressive work.
Thank you. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive.